someone is going over time or inform them they're going into their rebuttal time. Are there any other preliminary matters by either party?
No, thank you.
No, sir.
Very well. On behalf of this matter, we are now on record in Neustadt versus Cola Francesca. Matters before the court for oral argument. And as such, Scott Ludwick will argue on behalf of the appellant, and Mark Colafranceschi will argue on behalf of the respondent cross appellant. As such, Mr. Ludwig, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice and Honorable Justices. Thank you for this opportunity. I have an appeal on what I would call the interesting issue of the insurance policy post-divorce. Mr. Colafranceschi appealed everything else, and so I will make quick work of addressing what he will be addressing in his appeal, because I believe those are easy matters. So I won't take very much time, and then I'll address my appeal on the insurance issue next, if that's okay with you all procedurally.
I don't find any problem with that.
Okay.
You may proceed.
So the parties were married in May of 2012. I represent Julie Neustadt, Your Honor. And they entered into a premarital agreement. The record was clear that they negotiated the terms of the final document with their respective attorneys.
Just to be clear, counsel, did you represent her at the time the premarital agreement was signed?
No. No. So the premarital agreement between the parties is very clear on many things, and I'll just cut through those very quick and realize that was entered into on May 20th, 2012. And so virtually everything that's going to be told to you happened prior to that date. There is one instance regarding inducement after the parties separated that appellant will tell you that he was induced to come back into the residence for promises of receiving an asset that my client doesn't even own. But nevertheless, the premarital agreement has some very salient points. Judge Williamson and Judge Scott covered those very clearly. But as of the date the document was entered on May 20th, 2012, and this is Exhibit A in the trial, there were no prior agreements or understandings between them for any joint control or ownership of their respective properties. Neither one could claim in the future any of the other party's assets or income. And I'm just going to cut through this very quick, but the agreement was executed voluntarily. It was certified by their attorneys, who each said they fully explained the terms and conditions of the prenuptial agreement or premarital agreement. It wasn't unconscionable as of the date of execution. It was Mr. Colafranceschi represented in 3.4. He would have no right in the future property that Julie Neustadt acquired. And that neither, again, section 4.1, it's beating a dead horse, but there's probably about six or seven times where it says neither of them will acquire any ownership in another the other person's property. And prior conduct is important because you'll hear about all the things that led up to this, but it states that the conduct of a party in paragraph 4.3 in the past, present, or future does not mean or imply agreement, promise, or understanding between the parties except as set forth in this agreement. It's a very comprehensive premarital agreement. Covers the Idaho Code Title 32 requirements on these too. The life insurance policy, I'll get to that. That's paragraph 4.8, and that's where the action is here. Waives spousal support. And the purpose for waiving spousal support wasn't related to this insurance policy. It was to save substantial litigation costs which could be involved in determining spousal support. That's in paragraph 10.1, 10.2, no mention of an insurance policy. Section 16 covers the subsequent inducement also, and anything that happened prior to May 20th, 2012. It says this is the entire agreement. There's no other promise or undertaking. Anything that is going to modify the terms and conditions of here, this document need to be in writing and notarized, and each party waives the right to claim or assert that this agreement was altered, modified, amended, revoked, canceled, superseded, or changed indirectly or directly by an oral agreement, course of conduct, estoppel, or marriage. Paragraph 20.1, advice of counsel. Each party understands the contents and legal practical effects of this agreement. Like I said, each attorney had described to them and signed a certificate of that attorney. Aubrey Numbers is a talented attorney. Stan Welsh testified at this along the way in this case and talked about her experience level and how she was an excellent attorney. Then there's a provision in Section 23 that provides that if there is a provision in this otherwise enforceable premarital agreement that would be invalid, void, or voidable, it would not impact the remaining document, and the remaining provisions would remain unimpaired. So I guess I just wanted to cite all those provisions. There's more that address the same things I did, but as of May 20th, 2012, all of the things that were outlined in the appeal were handled and this agreement was signed. And then there's many quotes of Mr. Colafranceschi saying, I didn't understand the provision with regard to doesn't recall reading it. I guess that's what it says. Did not understand what it meant. The same things we hear all the time. I've prepared 300 of these in my career. It is what it is. As long as you follow that Title 32, you get a document that impacts the future handling of community property and domestic relations. The other issues in this matter, denial of the motion to disqualify, it, that is what it is. I thought there was a very thorough opinion by both Judge Scott and Judge Williamson on reconsideration, that the prenup was unconscionable. That was a matter of law handled by Judge Williamson at the summary judgment. So in conclusion on this, because I don't want to spend too much time on it, but there was substantial and competent evidence supporting Judge Williamson's finding. There's 800 pages of transcript, probably 20 of the pages from the Dorris case are really relevant to this volatile soap opera these parties lived through for 4 years. And to Judge Williamson's credit, she allowed virtually everything to be stated that could possibly be stated by Mr. Colafranceschi. One thing that I do want to point out is he would say he was coerced into waiving the right to have a trial on the grounds of extreme cruelty. I would say, along with what Judge Scott said in his appeal, there's no evidence of that whatsoever, that there was any coercion by Judge Williamson. In fact, in the transcript of the trial, Mr. Colafranceschi states that he wasn't intending to pursue, right here on page 512, the Mr. Colafranceschi states in his opening argument, first paragraph, and with all due respect to the court, I do not intend to pursue any claim of extreme cruelty. Now, the court knows that that factor in a divorce was reserved in the event Judge Williamson's decision was reversed. Of course, Judge Scott reversed that on the insurance provision, 4.8 of the premarital agreement. And now it's before you here today. In the event you affirm Judge Scott and reverse Judge Williamson's decision on that, then we're back in front of the judge for a trial on the grounds, which the relevant grounds is extreme cruelty to avoid this policy. So on the appeal, it's clear there's substantial evidence that supports the finding Judge Williamson and Judge Scott affirmed on that matter. Unless the court has any questions on that, I would move to the insurance issue, which, as I've described, is the interesting issue here.
There to be none, sir.
Thank you. With regard to the insurance issue, so as you know, in paragraph 4.8 of the premarital agreement, it provides for Ms. Neustadt to obtain a term, 30-year term life insurance policy naming Mr. Colafranceschi as the sole beneficiary. And of course, we've never contended that during the marriage that policy wasn't enforceable. Unfortunately, the marriage was volatile. It was awful. Divorce papers were prepared in 2012 by Mr. Colafranceschi. They separated. There's allegations of extreme cruelty both ways, although they stipulated to a divorce on the grounds of reconcilable differences to avoid that dog and pony show. Nevertheless, we asked the court to avoid that continued beneficiary of Mr. Colafranceschi on a 30-year term policy as a matter of law. And Judge Williamson wrote a decision and, in effect, agreed that it was a wager and that there was no protectable interest or insurable interest that Mr. Colafranceschi had post-divorce. There was no child support. There was no equalization payment. There was no business interest that the parties kept together. There's no judgment against Ms. Newstead that she had to pay. There's nothing she had to do to deliver post-divorce for him that would have created that sort of interest. And of course, they contracted for it. And so we asked the court, and the court agreed that it was a wager and it was not supported by Idaho law because there was no insurable interest. And in effect, it was a wager. So it where we are now is we still assert that, of course, that it was a wager on Julie's life and nothing else, and that it's void against public policy. Now, we
Before we go further, yes, I know sir. You weren't representing Newstead at the time of the signing of the document, but do you know why there wasn't a collateral, reciprocal provision concerning life insurance on Mr. Colafranceschi?
I do not. In fact, my client professes she was unaware of this provision, but we see that with people in these premarital agreements always claiming they don't know what's in those documents, but she...
accused Mr. Colafranceschi of saying he's not aware. Now you're saying Right. Your client wasn't aware. So it sounds like perhaps both sides maybe are more aware than they want to admit.
Of course. We can't stand behind any door other than the one that's open that says that's a provision in the contract that she executed and she's held to the same standard, of course, that Mr. Colafranceschi is. Did she know that they would be divorced in 4 years after a volatile marriage and now he had 26 more years of being a beneficiary on her life insurance that she had to pay for no reason whatsoever? I doubt she understood that, but we can't stand behind that at this moment. So I want to tell you that the possibilities, and I'm going to point out some differences of our analysis of Judge Scott's review of a will and intestate succession statute in the probate code, but the possibilities and why it makes so much sense not to have somebody wagering on somebody else's life with nothing else involved in this sort of situation. A year after this divorce is over, we were involved in three more matters with Mr. Colafranceschi. And I point these out as purposes of example why policies like this that have a beneficiary without an insurable interest should be void. So in the following year, we had a vexatious litigant order that the Supreme Court eventually saw. We obtained a protection order for stalking when Judge Oss, after a trial, found Mr. Colafranceschi had come through a doggy door into the house. That was awfully scary for Julie Newstead. Then we had to stand for a 3-day jury trial with allegations of battery and abuse, where it resulted in a $1 verdict for a, I assume.
Are we going off?
No, sir, you're not to interrupt. Thank you.
Okay.
You may answer these, his remarks when you, have your time, sir. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm using this to point out the possibilities and why these should be void against public policy, because there's lots of things that can happen that would make these things awful. In that jury trial, we received approximately a $50,000 award of fees because it was frivolous. 3 days, all these false allegations and a $1 verdict because they had to give a dollar if they thought that she had touched him. I'm just saying you could have somebody that is a beneficiary of a life insurance policy like this sitting in prison that had murdered somebody or had, I'm not referring to Mr. Colafranceschi here, but the possibilities, the divorce may have ended, and right after the divorce is entered, the spouse who is a beneficiary of the policy commits a serious domestic violence issue against this spouse and ends up in prison and he's the beneficiary of an insurance policy, it's a wager. And it should be void against public policy. I want to address what Judge Scott said. Judge Scott was focusing on the fact that it may have been a wager, but it wasn't Mark Cole or Franceschi's wager. It was Julie's wager. Well, she was being forced to continue this policy post-divorce. There's nothing in the Idaho law that says she can't insure him if she voluntarily wants to. And I want to continue this insurance policy post-divorce. It's the fact that she doesn't want to, it doesn't make sense to, and it's a void that she would have to do so as a matter of this contract.
But is Mr. Colafranceschi wagering on her life, or is Julie Neustadt wagering on her
life? In effect, it's both. She's paying the premium on a life insurance on her life, which may or may not ever be effectuated 22 years down the road now. So they're both wagering when they entered into that contract on her life, but she doesn't want to wager on her life anymore.
But there's nothing to prohibit somebody from purchasing a term life policy on their own life, is there? Isn't
that's
that what
correct.
You're asking us to do?
That's the differentiation is that she doesn't want to now. If she wanted to, she could. I don't know of any insurance company that won't take the policy premiums because it's all a matter of risk. And gambling.
To but she's entered into a contract to do exactly that, hasn't she?
She did. Right. There's no, absolutely no secret that she executed that contract. It provides for a life insurance policy for 30-year term. And the divorce was 4 years later. And that she, of course, doesn't want to maintain a life insurance policy. And our position is that under the law, it's a wager and there's no insurable interest here. And Judge Williamson, like I said, agreed, it is a wager, it's against public policy, and there was no, it doesn't effectuate any good public purpose. I did want to point out, because Judge Scott wrote an amended opinion because he came across a probate statute, which is under the Title 15, Intestate Succession Dash Wills, of course, is what it's called, and it's 15-2804, excuse me. That is about wills. And we believe Judge Scott had to really expand or infer a lot to apply this to this particular insurance policy. And I would also submit, because this is not about insurance policies, this particular statute, but I do want to point out there's a difference between a will, and if somebody contracted to have a will post-divorce, and that we have those happen. We execute contracts on occasion, long-term marriages, when they have a concern that there may be a new family, more kids, spreading the inheritance. People do that quite often. They enter into contracts post-divorce to have a will. This is different. In a will, there's no guessing. Somebody's going to die eventually. An insurance policy is unwritten, is underwritten, and is speculative, and the event may or may not happen within the time frame gambled upon. Julie may live 40 more years. I hope so. But we're in a situation where it is different, and it's a different instrument and vehicle than a will. So I guess our position is that Judge Williamson was right with regard to this probate statute. It doesn't apply, and it is void against public policy to force her to keep a policy naming Mr. Colafranceschi as a beneficiary in a $2 million policy after a four-year marriage that was very volatile. Thank you so much.
Mr. Colafranceschi, it is now your time to argue the case. May okay. proceed, sir.
Thank you, Justices, for hearing this case. I'm going to do 15 minutes on life insurance, give or take, and then proceed with the appeal. This issue, according to the docket,
Could you wait just a second, sir? It seems as if someone has some music going on in the background. Could we make sure that has turned off?
Yeah, I don't have control over that. I'm at the airport in a private lounge. That's separate from that. Is that
you
is
may
that
proceed then? You may proceed.
So the insurable interest is what was argued at the magistrate level, with nothing about public policy or evil or wagering per se is what's argued now. It appears now that the opposing counsel wants a second jab at this, claiming public policy with all these other ancillary things that he brings up that weren't part of the magistrate or the district court, nor were part of this appeal as well. Mr. Ludwig erroneously stated things that Judge Scott stated that I'll address separately. But what I want to deal with first is that in opposing counsel's reply brief stated February 18th, 2020, page 6, it's clear Julie can insure her life and name anyone she wants as a beneficiary, whether there's insurable interest or not. Julie is not contesting this. Scott spent about the first 7 minutes talking about the fact that even though he wasn't the attorney at drawing up the premarital agreement, it was voluntarily, it was it was conscionable, it was comprehensive. All those aspects that he presented to the court are the reasons why this provision is valid. He's not in any of his arguments providing evidence or support in his brief at the magistrate, district, and the Supreme Court level that there is any evil or public policy risk. Now, I wanted to go through a couple of the cases that he brings up. He brings up List versus List, Browning versus Browning, and then the Walton case to establish this public policy and overturning. And the flagrant things that are done by opposing counsel is fragmenting the contract. And if you look at Stern versus William, it's an Idaho case that refers to this Walton case, a contract that goes against public policy is a question of law to be determined by all the facts and circumstances of the case. That's not what's being done by Mr. Ludwig. Second, in Crimmins Pierce Company versus Keter Peabody Acceptance Corp, what stated is an agreement voluntarily made between competent persons is not likely to be set aside in grounds of public policy or because it turned out unfortunate for one party. It's exactly what opposing counsel is arguing. Julie regrets having a life insurance policy that's going to stick for post-divorce. I don't think she regrets not having to pay alimony or spousal support or property distribution in an alimony setting. Lastly, in J.C. Penney Incorporated versus Koff, again cited by Mr. Ludwig in his Worlton case, reviewing a contract in an attempt to determine the true meaning, the court must review the entire contract without fragmenting. And I do this in my appeal brief, as I explain that through my testimony, through Julie's testimony, through everybody's testimony, alimony was waived, spousal support was waived in lieu of this life insurance. It was Julie voluntarily due to this to save money in the case of a divorce, and by her words, and these are stated in the appeal, is that there's no effing way she's going to pay anybody spousal support and all the different aspects of why and how the contract came to be. It's established that the life insurance was property distribution to cover the divorce. The case versus List versus List, they specifically, and I'll read what they say, they looked at the entirety of the contract and it suggested that the life insurance was not intended as a component of property distribution scheme, as a former wife suggested, but instead intended solely to protect child support interest. That's not what's going on in this case. There's no alimony, there's no spousal, so the life insurance wasn't intended for that. This List versus List has nothing to do with this case. And Browning versus Browning, again, an error in bringing this up, because it states that this case presents a scenario where husband seeks to eliminate wife as beneficiary for existing policy. Instead, wife is attempting to obtain a new policy on her husband after his financial obligation to her ceases. So if I were to try to obtain a policy on Julie at this point, again, it would go against public policy. There's no insurable interests. Again, Browning versus Browning is wasting our time. So in admitting these, it's a concern. Mr. Ludwig wants to go off on these tangents, and the nefarious actions of the vexatious litigant claim and the protection orders are mind-boggling. And the reason I objected, Your Honor, is because it wasn't part of the record, and I didn't want to have to rebut something that's not part of the record, because then I'm going to be scolded for talking about things that are not part of the record. I can tell you that if we were to take the time and to look at the vexatious claims and the protection order, that was a criminal act on Scott Ludwig and on Julie Neustadt, making affidavits and claims to the court completely fraudulent. It would make people's hair turn on the back of their neck, because it was the most egregious thing. And for Mr. Ludwig to make the innuendos or the accusations of this being evil or bringing up murderers in jail holding life insurance policies is just so insulting to this court and to himself to stoop to those levels where there's no facts relating to this in this case that are on the record. So I hesitate to go down that path. I think it's a trap or a lure for Scott to deflect and to have me go off tangent. And I apologize if I'm getting worked up with this, because I believe it's uncalled for. If the court would give me an hour, I could prove that Scott should be charged criminally for the vexatious litigant. I could again prove Scott should be charged criminally for the protection order. Again, that's not what we're here for today. We're talking about life insurance. So in my brief, I explain at length and through testimony of both Julie and myself that life insurance was intended as a substitute for alimony and spousal support. Now, at this point, that doesn't even really matter, because even if it wasn't, the life insurance provision is property distribution. It's a contract. It was voluntarily made. It was conscionable, and it was for Julie to save money. Now, why it wasn't reciprocal is it wasn't part of the actual agreement. Julie had every possibility to have that life insurance policy put on myself. I don't have a life insurance policy for my child. I don't have a life insurance policy for myself. And based on my resources, I didn't have the ability to pay for that life insurance policy. If it were presented, I'm sure it would have been incorporated with it. It wasn't an issue. So I hope that helps with the reciprocal part of it. It was never brought up. I think if the court would inquire about some of the deflective aspects of what Mr. Ludwig said, that Julie didn't remember the life insurance provision, while you refer to the emails that Julie sent and received to Mark Peters in the negotiation of this premarital contract, you'll see that that's completely bogus. And when you look at my claims of not completely understanding, I knew what I was getting into with the premarital agreement. My understanding was that, and the promise was that all properties would be joint equity properties. I didn't understand how trusts work. And at this point, I do somewhat understand how they work. For anybody to say that what I represented to the courts wasn't 100% accurate and credible is completely misleading. Because if you look at the emails that I sent to Mark Peters and Audrey Numbers that we're all involved with, I specifically stated what my intent was and what the promise was regarding property. So I'm not going to go too far into property. We'll get to that in a minute. So what I want to do is I want to finish up with the life insurance. And if there's any questions on the life insurance, I'd like to address those too. So when it comes to the $2 million policy and their expert witness, Stan Welsh, coming to testify, who reviewed that at length. And if you look at the my respondent brief dated January 21st, 2020, I go in and I explain in detail Stan Welsh's testimony upon examination by Scott Ludwig on the enforceability, the conscionability, and the thorough aspect of this premarital contract. Nowhere did Stan Welsh, their expert witness, claim that Section 4.8 went against public policy, was evil, was in any way to be voided post-divorce. That wasn't brought up. He had the opportunity to bring Stan Welsh back after he decided to do otherwise. He didn't. So, so that was on page 12 and 13, Stan Welsh's, of my respondent brief dated January 21st, 2020, where Mr. Ludwig and Stan are establishing that the entire premarital agreement, in their opinion, was enforceable. Nowhere after the fact did Mr. Ludwig have an expert or an attorney undo what Stan had stated under the record. Mr. Ludwig even stated that on page on August 3rd, 2016, that he just wasn't happy with the document the way it turned out to be the final document. And they've done everything and anything to include making this crazy claim of habitual intemperance with a person who drinks very little or seldom drinks, that he was habitually intemperate as a desperation move. And then the extreme cruelty and the false claims that I was physically or emotionally abusive to Julie, there's not a shred of evidence to support that. If you could tell me, am I close to 15 minutes on this?
Sir, you have 17 minutes and 29 seconds left.
So one of the important parts in the rulings of both lower courts is under oath, I testified that knowing that alimony or spousal support was not part of the prenuptial agreement, that was my spousal support, and I didn't ask for alimony or spousal support or any type of settlement. In lieu, I asked for life insurance and equity in the home. That was trial transcript, page 639. Again, this is all outlined in my brief. The two things I negotiated for in lieu of alimony is spousal support. In lieu of spousal support or alimony was equity in the homes and the life insurance provision, because Julie had stated there's no effing way I'm ever paying you alimony. When I asked Julie on testimony, trial transcripts, page 882, did you claim that there's no way I was getting alimony? Julie said, I don't recall any of our conversations. I don't recall. What we have is several instances where I asked Julie, what was the provision for life insurance put in for? Were you aware of it? And again, we've got all this conflicting testimony. Again, I think that and the alimony has very little to do with it. She contracted for a provision for life insurance. And if you look at, instead of fragmenting this as Scott has done, and look at the totality of it, you have an agreement where her trust, her personal finances are unscathed at the end of the divorce. So there's a benefit to her. So if you look at the conscionability of a separation agreement or a premarital agreement, and you look at, okay, what does she lose at the end of the marriage if the marriage were to terminate? And in this case, half equity in a home doesn't take from her trust. The minimal amounts of a life insurance policy don't take from her trust. Paying spousal support for 5, 10, whatever years takes from her trust. And so that's what I'm asking this court is to look at in its totality, is that Julie or her trust or her attorney did very well financially in doing the life insurance over alimony because it has no effect on her trust. Same thing with the equity in the property. Is there any questions on the life insurance before I move on? On the motion in limine, I think it's pretty straightforward in my appeal. It's relating to how the motion in limine was brought forth, how it was, there was no order to shorten time, there was no notice to shorten time, there's not even a notice of hearing titling that, and it was ignored by the district court, understandably because he reversed the decision, but I'm asking the courts to just reverse that. So going into the my cross appeal part, it leaves section one and section three. The section one has to do with discovery and future discovery. And this is where Mr. Ludwig claimed to the court 25 minutes ago that Judge Scott said that there was no coercion. And that's just completely wrong, because Judge Scott did not say that. Judge Scott says he's not dealing with the issue of coercion. It's moot at this point. Judge Scott did not say there was no coercion. He did not address it. He remanded the issue of extreme cruelty to the district court, or so the magistrate court. Now, what again has been misled is that the extreme cruelty on Kulafinczewski's side is completely separate from Julie's side. The extreme cruelty has to do with unequal distribution of assets because of extreme cruelty, something that hasn't been understood and respected at the magistrate level, where Judge Williamson, and you'll see in the brief where she says, you get nothing, you get nothing. What would you benefit from filing extreme cruelty? You get nothing. Well, again, I think you guys are in the understanding that in the case of extreme cruelty, there can be an unequal distribution of assets. And that's what I'm seeking, nothing to do with the life insurance. Now, in the likely event, based on what Mr. Ludwig has stated and written, that they will appeal the life insurance on extreme cruelty, habitual and temperaments, or whatever they can conjure up, I think discovery issues are important. There's a lot of allegations, and again, Mr. Ludwig bringing up this vexatious litigant thing, the fact that Julie has perjured herself multiple times and over 50 different times claimed that she didn't recall or can't recall, is selective about what she remembers and what she doesn't remember. And the fact that they've used this vexatious litigant claim and false claims about protection orders and fear when she knowingly knows they're to be false. And she made similar claims on Jacob De La Rosa, a cardiopulmonary specialist, a doctor I know and I refer some of my patients to, a great guy, that he was part of the Colombian cartel, that he beat her, that he was on and on and on. And these discovery issues that I'm now considered a vexatious litigant about directly relate to Julie's pattern of doing whatever she can to manipulate the system. And so these discovery issues and the discovery issues of Julie's past physical abuse on me and present aspects of what she's been doing with death threats and making up false criminal claims and other type of issues, I believe are important to be discoverable information when or if this goes to the magistrate level on extreme cruelty. I'm not sure if you have any questions on that. If you do, please ask, and I'm going to go on to the fraud by inducement.
Seemed to be none, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So lastly, I want to talk about the fraud by inducement. I'm a little concerned because on the notice that the Supreme Court put out for this hearing, it says that the lower court's finding that Mark failed to prove he was fraudulently induced to sign the premarital agreement. is concerning because it doesn't incorporate the most egregious aspect of the fraud of inducement, which happened post-marriage as well. Equally important is the fraud by inducement that happened pre-marriage, in which Julie promised, you'll get equity in the homes, Now, if I didn't leave the home in December of 2014, and this issue didn't get tested then, I think my fraud by inducement claim would be moderate to weak. Now, the fact that it got tested and the testimony and the evidence, including Carol Griffith, myself, and Julie, failing to recall Julie being recorded because she admittedly would make things up when her back was against the wall or when she didn't get her way. And all these facts were ignored, egregiously ignored by both lower courts. And what happened at the district court level is Judge Scott simply took Julie's direct testimony from Scott Ludwig, saying, I didn't sign anything, I didn't agree anything to him with respect to property. And when I cross-examined her, I said, is it possible we talked about that? Or did you read the email that you sent or received to Mark Peters talking about property? I don't recall. Maybe I did. Maybe I promised. I just told you what I told you because I just wanted to shut you up. Well, you look at the totality of this and you look at the fact that it got tested the second time. It's not just the fraud by inducement in the 4 days before the signing of this premarital agreement. It was what happened 2014, 2015, and subsequently from 2015 when I re-entered the marriage on that promise that I would get equity in the home to when I left. It's overwhelming. And every single aspect of those nine elements were verified and quantified by evidence, testimony, and support. And so by both lower courts ignoring those glaring things, testimony of Carol Griffith, testimony of Julie, and ignoring those things, testimony of myself, it becomes overwhelming for me because the aspect of the fraud inducement is pretty lengthy with lots of testimony. The confusing part, like I said, is the fraud induced by inducement is twofold. And the twofold nature of it is maybe we were unclear at the beginning, but when I left the marriage and refused to come back because Julie making things up, Julie being financially abusive, physically abusive, and begged me to return back to the home, and I said, I'm not coming back. And she said, what do I need to do to reconcile this? I said, well, you need to take ownership of the false allegations you made. And she did that. And that one of the emails is in there where she emailed saying, when my back's up against the wall, I make things up and nobody deserves that. And we did, I think, 20 or 30 intense marriage counseling sessions. And our counselor said point blank to me, Mark, it's safe for you to move back. She's going to do this and there's no way she can get out of it. And her attorney's out of town. Her attorney's out of the country. It's going to get done, Mark. It's going to get done. And this is the exact nature of fraud by inducement. It's the exact nature of it, where you keep on promising somebody, and you keep on promising, and you keep on promising until the foundation falls out, and it's like, well, the promise has to be settled because you made that promise, and people relied on that promise. And the fiduciary duty of a spouse is significantly different than other business relations, and I respect that, and I understand that. I respect all the clauses that Scott Ludwig has gone off and repeated over and over again with respect to the premarital agreement. I agree and understand that. And again, if it wasn't tested in 2014 and 2015, again, moderate to weak argument I have. Now I have a very strong argument because it was tested and it was validated. It was validated not just between us, between Julie's attorneys, and between a marriage counselor that cared deeply about both of us and making our marriage work. And so, I don't want to read and go through all the different aspects of the fraud by inducement, but I want to point out where both Judge Scott and Judge Williamson ignored the testimony of Julie and Carol Griffith and myself, and the overwhelming amount of credibility issues with Julie making perjury statements and repeatedly claiming that I don't recall, I don't recall, I don't recall. Or when she was asked, is it possible? She'd always say yes to protect herself because she didn't know how many videos or what videos were allowed and what weren't allowed. And if you look closely at her testimony that's within my brief, that again, Mr. Ludwig does not refute, is when I asked, did you make that promise? Her response was, I never signed anything. I never signed anything. Well, I never signed anything. Like she was coached or parroted by an attorney to say, just say you didn't sign anything because we got a contract here and we're going to fall back on that. And it's hard to prove fraud by inducement, which it is. And in this case, I believe, and again, I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't have several attorneys saying, Mark, there's no question about this. She fraudulently induced you. And it's frustrating because the evidence was ignored at the lower courts. And when you look at the totality of it, and you look at how much effort I put in to that property, if you look at how we bought the property and the email and text message exchanges, it's going to be our house. It's our house. And then you look at the promises, in my understanding, before the prenuptial agreement, writing the prenuptial agreement, after the prenuptial agreement. And why would I do all these things? And if you look at the list of things, why would I go into a crawl space when we're living like millionaires, when anybody reasonably would have hired somebody to do it at four times the price, but who cares? It's not my money. It is my money. It was my equity. And without getting too emotional with it, it's clear. The other thing that was ignored by both the district and the magistrate courts is admitted exhibit 100, in which Carol Griffith was unusually called by Judge Williamson from the bench to testify by telephone, surprising. And then that wasn't part of the findings and facts and conclusions of law. It wasn't part of Judge Williamson's findings or Judge Scott's findings. My findings and facts and conclusions of law. All the irregularities in this case combined and connected with the life insurance and with the fraud by inducement and the discovery, I believe are overwhelming and concerning. I think that's it. And I thank you for your patience and your time today, Justices, and wish you well.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate the argument. On behalf of the respondent or of the appellant, how much time does he have?
11 minutes, Your Honor.
Very well. Sir, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice and Honorable Supreme Court. First, let me apologize. I didn't have my suit coat on when this started. You get casual sometimes, and that's my fault in these office settings. I just would say a couple things. There was never a modification. Mr. Colafranceschi, and it's in the record, prepared a modification after they separated in 2014, and Julie wouldn't sign it. So he was aware a modification was necessary in writing pursuant to the terms of the contract, and she would never execute that. So I don't know. No promise was ever effectuated, and he drafted a document. Also, Julie Newstead never owned a house. A trust in which she's a beneficiary, if the grantor were to predecease her, owns a house. So there was never a house. I just wanted to point that out. And then finally, listening to Mr. Colafranceschi and his continued accusations towards Julie and of course me and the court and Judge Williamson, all the things she said, leaves no wonder in my mind why maintaining a life insurance policy post-divorce for someone who does not have an insurable interest is void against public policy. That's all I'll say. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. At this time, this matter is now under advisement and we will render a decision. Court's in recess.
Thank you.